Okay, we'll call the meeting of the House Resources Committee to order, showing 1:02 p.m. on Friday, January 28th, 2011. Let the record reflect that the following members are present. Co-Chair Seaton, Representative Gartner, Representative Herron, Representative Wilson, and myself, Co-Chair Feige. Representative Dick is excused till a little bit later in the meeting. Purpose of our meeting today is to begin the overview process of the Department of Environmental Conservation. Today we will hear from the Commissioner's Office, the Division of Air Quality, and the Division of Environmental Health. At this time, we will now hear from Commissioner Larry Hartig. Commissioner, welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Co-Chairman Feige, Co-Chair Seaton, and members of the committee. I'm Larry Hartig, Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. I really appreciate this opportunity to start off the department's overview. And as you say, our air quality division and our environmental health division will also be presenting today. And with me today are directors from each of those division, Kristen Ryan and Alice Edwards. And Alice, I congratulate her. She just became our director after being our acting director for 2 years, so we're happy to have her on board. I was planning on the overview to have about 20 minutes of presentation, if that sounds good to the co-chairs, and then open it up for questions. And I would like to stay for the whole hearing, but I have a House Finance overview also this afternoon, so at some point I'll have to duck out, but it'll be well after the time I was of my presentation.
Yeah, that should work out fine, Commissioner.
Thank you. Okay, I'll start with quick overview of our what it is we do in DEC's mission. Our mission, simply put, is to protect human health and the environment. We make sure that the air you breathe, that the water you drink, the food that you eat, and the environment you live in is healthy. There's a strong nexus in our mission between human health and the environment, and you look at all our programs and they're built around that, you know, to make sure that we keep people healthy by keeping their environments healthy. The department's is guided by, of course, statutes and regulations, and our primarily statutes are found in Title 46. There's some in Title 44, Chapter 46. They're split there, and then our regulations are in 18 AEC. You'll find them there. Besides looking at the different media, the air, the water, and the land and food safety, we also have responsibility to be sure that hazardous waste, such things as crude oil, fuel, you know, stay in the pipes, stay in the tanks, and if they get out, that they're cleaned up in ways that they don't present an ongoing threat, you know, to human health and the environment. We also assure that public wastewater and private wastewater treatment systems, you know, whether for a community like Juneau or a wastewater treatment system for, say, a fish processing plant or a mining operation, are run appropriately so that they don't present a threat, you know, to human health and the environment. Going on to the next slide, talk a little bit in more detail about our responsibilities and functions. Like I say, they're derived from state statute and regulation, but also there's a heavy overlay of federal requirements. A lot of our programs are really built around federal requirements, and so you'll be familiar with such ones as the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, CERCLA, or also known as the Superfund statute. You might have heard of the Resource Conservation Recovery Act, or RCRA, which regulates hazardous waste and disposal of those, Safe Drinking Water Act. All these are the major federal acts that day-to-day, you know, we live with and operate with. We also have a significant amount of federal funding in our budget that is tied to the federal programs that we help implement in the state. In fact, about 30% of our operating budget is federal money, and on our capital budget, about 75%, a little bit less than that, is federal money. One of the things, of course, that we find ourselves having to do is when you have these complex federal requirements that are intended to operate nationally, is goal be the goal between many of our communities, you know, including the smallest villages to up to Anchorage, the goal between them and the federal government in trying to make these national federal requirements, you know, fit and work in Alaska. And we often are, I think of that as the oil in that machinery, you know, to make sure that, you know, EPA requirements that may be coming in to a small village, you know, that they don't disrupt things and that we comply, that we help them comply with the law, but in ways that, you know, make sense. Okay. And going on to some of our responsibility and functions now, we develop standards both for air pollution, water pollution, pollution to land, spill prevention. These standards, I would emphasize, are science and engineering based. I think of our department as primarily consisting of scientists, engineers, and that the standards that we put out, as much as the public likes to debate them back and forth, you know, in terms of, you know, development philosophy or environmental philosophies, you know, when it comes down to our department, you know, we're based on the science, you know, we're based on the engineering, and that's the way we set our standards. Also, in setting our standards, we follow a public process, you know, that we go through a regulatory process where there's public notice and the public has an opportunity to weigh in on those. Our standards are set that way. And then not only do we set standards, then we monitor compliance with those standards. We periodically update our standards based on new science and our experience in the state. And then we also developed the testing protocols for, you know, how do we test compliance with our standards or how our standards are working. You know, so we're developing the lab tests or implementing lab tests that federal government have developed. So it's a very complex system. You know, when we talk about setting standards, it isn't just picking a number. You know, that each of these, you know, have years and years behind their development and implementation, and I want to stress that. These standards, when they're developed, then they end up in permits. You know, when people want to discharge, you know, pollutants, you know, of any kind to water or air or to the land, and we can authorize that just so there's not, you know, unwanted or unacceptable environmental consequences, you know, according to our laws and regulations and standards. And we use the standards that we set to determine what the permit requirements will be. And then we require, again, monitoring and testing to make sure that people are complying with those standards and the standards are actually working. The standards can be very complex, and so we find ourselves sometimes, you know, working with different communities and operators to, you know, help them maintain compliance with the permit requirements. And if they can't maintain compliance, we have enforcement capacity. You know, we have police powers in our department where we can investigate, we can subpoena people, we can even bring civil and criminal actions, you know, through the Attorney General's department, the AG's, the law department. Also, though, within our department, even though we're relatively small, you know, have about approximately 500 people working for us at any point in time, and about operating budget of this year about $78 million and proposed for next fiscal year, 2012, about $80 million. We have a relatively large capital budget, about $78 million. And the reason for that is because we also have a facilities program within our Division of Water that helps both small and large communities on water and sewer projects. And I'll talk a little bit more about that when I talk about our water division. Again, a big piece of what we do is responding, you know, first, I guess, trying to keep oil in the pipeline and fuel in the tanks. But if it gets out, responding to those and then making sure land's cleaned up, you know, so that we don't have an ongoing human health or environmental concern. We also do food safety, and I'll talk about that a little bit more. And we operate the State Environmental Health Lab. If you haven't been there, you're certainly invited to go out and see it, and I encourage you to do it. But it's out on Tudor Road in Anchorage next to the Human Health Lab, and that's where we do work in terms of, you know, looking at testing for foods, you know, for food safety, at, you know, PSP testing, the paralytic shellfish poison testing. It's so important for Southeast and the shellfish industry. That's where that testing is done out at the Environmental Health Lab, and you'll be hearing more about that. And that's also where the state veterinarian is housed. We also regulate pesticides. Right now it's a very controversial subject. The Alaska Railroad is, has got a permit from us recently and is looking for additional permits to spray, you know, along the railway right-of-way to try to control vegetation, you know, in the bed there. And those are always controversial. They always get appealed, pesticide permits. The other thing that we do is, again, that we're an enforcement agency, you know, where we're not getting compliance with environmental requirements, you know, we can investigate and prosecute. Going quickly to our divisions, we have five divisions within the department. Our Department of Administration, Laura Beeson, who's here, she's our acting division director. And as of Monday, our division director will be taking over, Mary Soroki. And Laura's our deputy director then of that division. They, as the name implies, they provide informational services, financial services, grant oversight, help with budgeting, procurement, building, leasing, and maintenance. And some of the challenge I might mention in that division is one is the increased lease costs that we're seeing across the board. We've had an increase over the last few years total in our leases of about $1.4 million, and we have an operating increment this year of about a little over $400,000. So just in the last few years, we've absorbed about $1 million in lease costs. And so for a relatively small department, you know, that's significant, and particularly when you consider a lot of our operating money, as I mentioned earlier, comes from the federal government and has strings attached to it where we can't necessarily use that to absorb the lease costs. So that's one ongoing challenge we have, and another is just the complexities of the federal programs that we run where we get money in that we can put out for grants and loans, particularly through our water division. We've seen about a 50% increase in the number of grants that we're doing, you know, just in the last, you know, 5-10 years. And so it's, you know, we see continued growth in that department and continued complexity with federal laws and requirements and grant requirements, although we've been keeping a fairly steady state budget. The other thing to mention on the Division of Administration, that's where our Environmental Crimes Unit resides. We have two criminal investigators. Both are in Fairbanks at this time, and one civil investigator is located in Anchorage. And they're more highly trained people, you know, so that if we get into a situation that, you know, could go into litigation, and particularly a criminal situation, you know, they can help working with the AG's office to make sure the investigation is handled properly and the prosecution is done properly. They also have the ability then to assist the program people, you know, in terms of investigation, where the program people would be can also, you know, do enforcement, but they also do compliance assistance. And so they're a great help to the department, but they reside in Division of Administration rather than in one of the divisions and within a program. Next, talk about our environmental health. There you'll hear from Kristen Ryan in more detail, but among the interesting things they do is food safety inspections, public water systems, running the environmental health lab. And I might mention just that some of the new initiatives that we have out there, and you'll probably hear more about them, is on shellfish. You might remember last summer there was a couple incidents, one in Juneau and one in Kodiak, where people got PSP and one person, I believe, died. Juneau, and so it's very serious. And we've on our PSP testing, we've been doing it for commercial operations, but we hadn't been doing it for recreation users. And the reason is just the state's so big. You know, we have more coastline than the rest of the country combined. And so how could you initiate a program like they have in Oregon and Washington? And it, we couldn't, you know, just physically couldn't. But what we're trying to do this year, we've asked for $40,000 initially in our capital budget, but it may get moved over into our operating budget, to initiate pilot programs for recreational beaches and try to couple up with a few local communities. We're guessing it'll probably be Juneau, Clam Gulch there on the Kenai, and then perhaps Kodiak, so that the local government could take the responsibility to gather samples, you know, where there's a lot of public use of beaches, and Homer, I left out Homer, but we include Homer, and then that they would send the samples to our environmental health lab for analyses. We would report back to them, and then they could get the information out to the public. And if we saw a PSP situation, then we could work with the local government to get the word out on that and do whatever else we need to follow up on that. Moving to our Division of Air Quality, again, Alice Edwards is with us today, the director, and you'll be hearing from her. But I mentioned just a couple quick of the challenges that we have there and some of the initiatives. As you know, EPA is moving forward with the regulation of greenhouse gases, including carbon dioxide, you know, emitted from the burning of various hydrocarbons. And right now, there's requirements for larger facilities, such as power plants, you know, larger operations on the North Slope, and then in communities, you know, like Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, et cetera, to track and report their greenhouse gas emissions. And that's a federal program right now. We don't run it, although we do help gather that data. We pay attention to the data for other reasons. But there's also requirements on these larger facilities now to be regulated in the permits that we issue for them. And it requires some decision-making on our part, particularly on what technology they're using to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And so that's we'll be developing, you know, within the state, you know, what are the technology standards applying to large greenhouse gas emitters, and that'll be a new challenge for the department. The other one that you might read about in the news is more in interior Alaska right now, but applies somewhat to Fairbanks, and depending on what EPA does in looking at tightening down on PM 2.5, the real small particulate matter that's emitted when you burn wood and other hydrocarbons. They're looking at tightening that standard maybe this next summer. But right now, Fairbanks is not meeting the existing standard, national standard for PM 2.5. It's considered a non-attainment area. So we're working closely with the borough up there through our air quality program to bring them into attainment. The other thing that we're doing, kind of a new initiative, is you know, looking forward on the North Slope. You see potential OCS development and drilling outer continental shelf. You see a potential gas line. You see Conoco trying to develop CD5, and with that, you know, helping out NPRA to the west, you know, of current operations there at Prudhoe. They're seeing the Liberty project with BP, you know, extending reach offshore to new areas. A lot of activity, you know, trying to be done on the North Slope, and what we want to make sure is that air quality issues don't become an impediment, you know, down the line. And right now they're bumping up against some air quality concerns, you know, that Shell's really been trying to get their permit and been held up. There's a risk that some of the other operators up there could run into some roadblocks down the line here on air quality issues. So what we're trying to do is get ahead of that curve at DEC and do additional air monitoring and modeling up there so we have a better handle on what the air conditions are up there and what we can and can't do and what EPA can and can't do is in terms of permitting, and try, if there's issues that we're going to get into, try to resolve those issues before they become a problem with development or permitting on the North Slope. So we're spending a lot of time looking at those sources and looking at it more holistically and trying to get ahead of the issues up there. Spill prevention and response, this is, I really think of this as kind of three pieces. There's the, it has three programs within it. There's making sure that, you know, trying to minimize the risk of spills, or industry preparedness program. And they're the ones that, you know, do the sea plan reviews. Those are the plans that people have to have in place, you know, where they handle a large amount or transport a large amount of oil and other hazardous substances to make sure they're going to reduce the risk of spills. And if there's one that there is a spill, that they're capable of responding to it. That's one program. And then if there's a spill that occurs, we have what I kind of consider our strike team, which is our PERT people, the Prevention Emergency Response Program. They're the ones that go out immediately when you hear about a spill and go out there and attack it and, you know, work with the spiller to address it. And then we have, thirdly, our Contaminated Sites Program. They're the ones to get out there on a longer-term cleanup and determine what the cleanup standards should be and oversee the long-term cleanup. One of the issues you'll hear about in SPAR is the response fund. That's the nickel a barrel surcharge you hear on crude oil production in Alaska. That's what funds the SPAR division. It also funds the what's called the response fund. That's the $50 million account that was set up after the Exxon Valdez oil spill. So if we have a major spill or a threat of a major spill, either I as Commissioner DEC or the governor can tap that fund, that $50 million fund, to have immediate access funds to mount a response. And, of course, we immediately notify the legislature. If you're not in session, then LBA. And so eventually gets back to the appropriate appropriation process. But that fund's there for to mount emergency response when we need it. And the problem with that is that that it funds both that $50 million account and bringing it back up to $50 million if we have to tap that fund, but and we can't get recover all the costs of the response from the responsible party. But there's also a portion of it that is used for operating costs for the SPAR division. And so as the decline in production goes down 6-7%, you're seeing annual decline in the amount that's coming in through that response fund and funding SPAR. And so that's an ongoing issue. And lastly, water quality. As I said, there's several components to that. There's the standards and the permitting side, you know, the water discharge permitting side of that, and that's where, you know, people that are going to discharge, or it's a water treatment plant, a sewage treatment plant, they're going to discharge the waters of the state. They need a permit from us, and we set permit conditions and monitoring, et cetera, on that. The other side of our water division is our facility side. And that's the water and sewer programs. That's our capital budget, by and large, that I mentioned earlier, the $78 million. And most of that money is federal money, 75% federal money that usually comes from EPA and from USDA, Department of Agriculture, and 25% match, which is state money, general fund money that the legislature appropriates each year. And the big challenge there is that the amount of federal funding has gone down 40% in the last 7 years. And so we're seeing this steep decline in the money that comes in there, and that's the money that we use for our Village Safe Water program, you know, smaller communities, 600 people or less, the villages, to get them water and sewer and to upgrade their systems. In our facilities program, we also have a program for larger communities, our municipal match and grant program, and that's this year in our capital budget, existing fiscal year 2011, that's about $23 million. Proposed for next year is $20 million. And that's an actual grant program where the state puts up a certain amount of money and then the local community puts up a matching grant of local money. There's no federal money generally. They can use federal money if they have it for the local match. But the local match, the amount of that depends on the size of the community. Anchorage puts more in than, say, a smaller community. So anyway, that's the overview of our department and divisions. And if it please the chair, co-chair, I'd be open for questions.
Commissioner Hardick, thank you very much for your presentation. Just before I open it up to the rest of the committee, just a couple of questions. Your personnel positions, how, of the authorized strength of your department, what percentage of those positions are filled?
We have, I think, 547 PCNs right now. I think that's the total number. And I have to get you the exact number, co-chair. It generally run about the same as the other departments. And I think I track it year to year more than I do the actual number. And I would say in terms of recruitment and retention, we're doing a little bit better than we were, say, 4 years ago. But we still really struggle for certain positions, you know. And so that number doesn't tell the whole story. It's where you get into engineers particularly, we have a really difficult time recruiting for engineers. We just don't compete against outside industry. You know, we will recruit, and it's not unusual for some positions to have, you know, one applicant, you know, or sometimes no applicants, and have to recruit three or four times. And then what we end up having to do is, you know, change the job description or something just so we can get a body in there. But we'll get to the figures on that.
Okay, thank you. And I assume you have an organization chart for the department as a whole.
Yes, we do.
Would it be possible for you to provide that? You send it to us, and I'll distribute, or send it to my staff, and we'll distribute it to the rest of the committee. Just so they have it as a reference.
Yeah, we'll follow up on that too.
And on the PM 2.5 program, which primarily seems to be a problem mostly in Fairbanks and during certain climatic inversion conditions. Is that a realistic standard that EPA is putting out there? And when I say realistic, is it realistically attainable for Fairbanks at a reasonable cost, and you know, specifically a reasonable cost to homeowners? Because a lot of that is just generated by wood smoke coming out of chimneys. And obviously for them to shut down their wood stoves is going to be significant cost to the citizens of Fairbanks.
Yeah, Quick Chair, if I, I'll give you my thoughts on that. And again, you'll be hearing from Alice Edwards, and she's much more the technical person than I am. But when there's kind of an evolution here, and I'll step back and kind of give you a little bit of the evolution and then talk about our approach to try to deal with just these issues you've identified. Is several years ago, EPA tightened the standard down for particulates, and I'll just get into the details of it. But we knew that they were as likely Fairbanks would become a non-attainment area, and also potentially Juneau, the Mendenhall Valley area. Because the, as you mentioned, the weather conditions, you know, they have these inversions during the winter that basically puts a lid on the air in that area and makes it, it's very stagnant. It doesn't move, doesn't flush out, doesn't mix. And so if you have wood smoke or other smoke that's being emitted, it just hangs in the air and stays there and becomes more and more concentrated. And the health concern is that you get these very small particles. The PM 2.5 is particulate matter, 2.5 microns. So it's extremely small, and it gets deep into the lungs, and there's recognized human health risks associated with that. I mean, it's a real human health hazard. So when we look at it in Fairbanks or Juneau, it's not simply a compliance issue. It's a human health issue, and that's why I keep stressing, you know, we're really about human health in our department. But the we also recognized in Fairbanks that as, just as this was happening several years ago, that's when diesel prices were skyrocketing. And you saw more and more people in the interior particularly, you know, switching to wood heat. And you were seeing promoters up there selling, you know, wood stoves and these wood boilers. And unfortunately, we didn't have national standards or state standards at the time to really regulate those, you know, to steer people towards more cleaner burning units. And so a number of units that got sold and are now in use up there are not the best technology. And so what to get to your question is, yes, we think that Fairbanks could come into compliance with the PM 2.5 requirements and do it in a way that they can still have affordable energy up there and that people can still burn wood. But it's going to, what has to happen is a number of different things. We have to, one, switch the people from the more dirty-burning wood stoves and boilers to cleaner technology, which is an expense and will take time. What we also have to do is we have to have a good supply of wood, because even if you have a cleaner-burning stove or a boiler, if you're burning wet wood, you're still going to get a lot of smoke. And so there has to be an understanding and an ability to have access to dry wood and burn dry wood. And that's a challenge up there because of, you know, the supply and the distance of the supply. I know that DNR and the State Forester have looked at what they can do from the Tennenaw Valley Forest, but it's a more distant, you know, from the people that have the wood stoves, and it's not that convenient for them, and then they need time to cure the wood, you know, so it has to be stacked somewhere and split and cured. So, you know, it'd be nice if there would be a commercial operation that could do that. And but all this has to fall in place. But if it does, we think that the improvements in the air quality you would see from all these things would be significant. Now, beyond that, it'll probably take more than that. And the question is how much more, other than just upgrading the wood stoves and getting dry wood. And I, again, I defer to our air quality director to go in more detail, but I can tell you we're spending a lot of time and effort up there, and her spending a lot of time and effort up there personally to make sure that we're carefully monitoring conditions up there and working closely with the borough and the University of Alaska Fairbanks being a big help on this to try to really understand, you know, what is causing the PM 2.5, where it's going, and if we do something here, you know, change something, what benefit are we going to get from it? Because before we ask people to make sacrifices or changes, we want to make sure it's worth doing.
Okay. And before we continue with questions, just want to recognize that we've been joined by Representative Foster, Representative Kawasaki, Munoz, and Representative Dick. Co-Chair Seaton, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if it becomes more appropriate for one of your directors, that's fine too. But there's, you know, from Seward, we've gotten some communications that DEC is adopting some new air quality rules for fugitive dust. And I'm wondering whether those are, what the time frame for those is to come out, as well as are those going to apply to the facilities that the rewrite of the standards or the rewrite of those rules is for, or the existing facility is going to be exempt under that new rules.
Thank you, Co-Chair Seaton, through the chair. That's basically correct what you said in terms of we are looking at making changes to our fugitive dust regulation. Right now we have a regulation. Well, first I should start with what is fugitive dust or fugitive emissions. And it's what we're talking, I guess, give an example. That's probably the easiest way is, you know, you think of such things as road dust, or you think of, you know, if you have a pile of, like in Seward, of coal, you know, where the train brings down the coal and they put it there on the dock before it gets shipped somewhere, and the wind comes and you know stirs it up and blows it. That's fugitive dust. You know, it's just generally released out in the atmosphere rather than through a, you know, confined stack, you know, like a power plant or wood stove that we were talking about. And so, you know, how do you control these kind of emissions? And again, our director get into this in more detail, but if it's a major facility, you know, say a large mine like the Red Dog mine, then we're going to have an air quality permit that we've issued for their power plant or other air emission sources. And when we would issue that major permit, we would then include provisions to control fugitive dust. And we have a requirement in our regulations that you have to use reasonable precautions against the emissions of fugitive dust. And if it gets too bad, you know, they could even violate an air quality standard, then we have hammers we can bring down on people there. But it's only, we've only been really regulating people under a permit if there are these larger facilities that need a permit anyway for some other reason, you know, in terms of air quality. And so you get these smaller facilities that don't require permits, air permits, and all there is then is the regulation to use reasonable precautions. Historically, if we've been having complaints from neighbors about fugitive dust, you know, dust being blown up from a construction site or whatever, pile of, you know, sand or coal or whatever, we can go and we can talk, you know, with the people and get it sorted out, and we generally get compliance, and usually good compliance. We can tell them about what works and what doesn't work and what we think they should do, and generally they do it. But you do, we have run into some situations, you know, including in sewer, where that hasn't worked. And so we are looking at now of having to go in and do more with our regulation to see whether we can have a more defined standard and a better way of enforcing that standard. And so we've looked at various options, and what our next step is to have some public hearings, and that's something that Alice Edwards can go into more detail. I don't remember the timing of that or the location of it. But our plan is to go out there and say, you know, here's our ideas on how we can regulate fugitive dust better from the smaller facilities. What does the public think about this? And then we would look at that and then go into a rulemaking. But I'll let her go into the timing and the detail of that, if you don't mind.
Okay. Representative Munoz.
Well, thank you, Chairman. In following up on the air quality questions regarding the PN2.5 issue, air quality in the Mendenhall Valley and Fairbanks, do you have access or do you review health data that may or may not be associated to those incidences in the communities?
Again, through the chair, I'll refer that to Alice Edwards. The short answer is yes. We pay a lot of attention to it, and there are some health studies that Alice Edwards can get into that, you know, we have looked at recently. But the short answer is, yeah, we're concerned about human health, and so we pay a lot of attention to those studies.
And then as a follow-up.
Go ahead.
And then just in general, if there appears to be concentrations of certain types of disease in a community, cancer, for instance, in a certain neighborhood, is it the DEC that would look at that as a human health concern? Or, I mean, what is the... what agency or how is that reviewed and determined that there may be a water issue or an air issue involved?
You know, that's a good question, too. The chair, I'll try to answer that. And again, it might be a question, too, that you would want to raise either with Alice Edwards or also it could come up with just about any of our divisions, actually. But the short answer on that one is yes. We work with Health and Social Service, you know, which is the state health department. And when I mentioned our environmental lab is located right next to them. You know, they're Anchorage off of Tudor Road by Boniface. And so when they see an instance of disease, if it's environmentally related or it could be a zoonotic disease. A lot of human diseases arise in animals. And, you know, we have the state veterinarian, we have the animal side of things, we have animal health within the environmental health division. And so we're paying attention, you know, to animal health, animals coming into the state, animals leaving the state. And so if we see diseases in the animal population that can move into the human population, we're talking with Health and Social Service. From their side, they might be tracking disease, instance of disease, location of disease in the human population. If they see something that is either environmental or animal related, they'd be talking with us. In addition, the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, you know, the federal agency, they track things. And I'm not totally familiar with what Health and Social Service and CDC require, but I know that for certain types of disease, they have a registry, and where an instance occurs, then a doctor's required to report that. And there's a national database, there's a state database, and that's tracked. And again, if they see something that's environmental related, then they contact us. But there's good communication and back and forth communication. And then also, I can tell you, one of the difficulties we run into, and it's frustrating for everybody, is in a state with a small population like Alaska and our communities with low populations, it's sometimes really hard to track whether you're seeing a higher incident of a particular type of disease or condition, because you just don't have a large enough population that's not statistically significant, you know, what you're seeing. You can't, it's really difficult to pin down and relate what you're seeing to a cause when you have really small populations. And
Can I follow up on that?
We're kind of running out of time here. I got three more folks that need to ask questions, and then we'll try to move on. So, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When you turn in your flow chart type thing, can you put the names of the department heads on that too also?
Yes, we will, Representative.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Dick?
No, I didn't.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment on your webpage on air quality. It's talking about Fairbanks North Star Borough's air quality complaint form. It's listed under hot topics.
Imagine that.
But I guess, you know, of course, the chairman wishes to move along here quickly. One in the last 12 months, or last time we saw you in the last session, one proud accomplishment that you and your department have done, and then if you want, could you share one disappointment?
Well, I'd say that I can think of accomplishments in each of the divisions. I kind of hate to single one out because the other directors might jump on me. But I think one of them, I mean, there's accomplishments in each of the divisions. But yeah, I didn't talk a lot about SPAR. So maybe I'll just pick that. You know, we wrapped up the main work that we were doing on the Alaska Risk Assessment. And, you know, we have an aging pipeline. You know, it's and it's past its original intended useful life, you know, and on the North Slope there, and so those areas that we regulate as a department, I feel like we've really made strong advances over the last 4 years in our oversight, you know, the pipeline safety, particularly the flow lines that DEC regulates, and I think that's extremely important to the state, particularly in what we're seeing with the Deepwater Horizon incident. But there's others, but that's one. In terms of disappointment, I say there's a couple of areas, but one that I'll just stick with SPAR, and that is that we haven't resolved the long-term solution on the response fund. You know, when I talk about that declining balance, you know, with the declining production that we're seeing, you know, how are we going to make up that difference and make that sustainable? And, yeah, I'd really like to see a solution come of that over the next year or two.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hardick. Appreciate your comments and answer questions. Before we move on to Ms. Ryan, we'll take a brief at ease, very brief at ease, and I'll give you time to go ahead and set up. Okay, we'll now hear from Ms. Kristen Ryan, Director of the Division of Environmental Health. Ms. Ryan, welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Kristen Ryan. I am the director for the Division of Environmental Health in the Department of Environmental Conservation. Following up with Commissioner Hardig, I'll just jump into the Division of Environmental Health. He gave, a really good overview of what we do, but I'll get a little more specific, and I know you have a PowerPoint to follow along with, too. First, to start off, there's the division mission. Our division mission is we deal with the basics, and our goal is to provide businesses with clear standards so they can protect our environment and provide safe food and drinking water to Alaskans. We have a lot of different issues in the Environmental Health Division that run the gamut of food to drinking water to pesticides to solid waste, as you'll see. So our overall goal is to provide clear standards for everyone so that they know the environment that they have to provide their services within. The next slide is just a quick organizational chart of the division. As I said, there's several programs. There's the Environmental Health Laboratory, the Drinking Water Program, which I'll talk about first, the Solid Waste and Pesticide Programs, which we have lumped into one management unit, so to speak, just for because they're very small programs and it's easier to have them together, the State Veterinarian's Office, and then Food Safety and Sanitation. So those are our main areas. My main job is to provide direction on the 9 regulatory chapters that we implement within this division to make sure that we're fulfilling the statutory mandates that we've been asked to implement, that we're managing our budgets correctly so that our resources are used wisely, and to provide clear direction for staff decisions and management choices, which takes a lot of time. So moving on, the first program that I'm going to cover today is drinking water. The drinking water program, the core services of the drinking water program are to assist federally regulated public water systems to enforce the standards for monitoring, to make sure they're monitoring for contaminants, to review construction, installation, operational plans, and engineering standards for the construction and modification of public water systems to make sure they're going to comply with the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act. We also spend a great deal of time assisting public water system owners in identifying their sources of drinking water and protecting them from contamination, future contamination sources. And we like to provide quite a bit of technical assistance to them to help them achieve that. And then let's go to the next slide then. So there are two, this program is broken into two main components. There are federally regulated systems and there are state regulated systems. So this slide covers the federally regulated systems. Those are basically systems that serve 25 people or more. That's simplifying it to a degree, but that gives you it's the larger systems in the state. And then we call the state regulated systems those that serve 25 people or less. For these federal systems, these 25 people or more, we've had primacy since 1978, since the beginning of the department, essentially. We are implementing the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act in Alaska because of this primacy. Drinking water is a little different than some of the other federal mandates. They have new rules that come down the pike every so often when they make amendments to the Safe Drinking Water Act. And we have to adopt each rule and get primacy for each rule. So there are 16 so far that we have, one pending approval. Actually, I think just yesterday I heard they approved it, and we have 4 more we're anticipating. The complexity has been increasing over the years as these new rules come down the pike, and it has become more difficult for our water systems to comply, that's no doubt. One nice thing, I know we're not talking about money, but EPA does give us $4 million a year to implement this program in Alaska for them. So we're happy about that. It requires some state match, though. There is a state contribution as well. There's about 1,500 of these systems in Alaska. 83% are groundwater. The majority, the smaller percentage is surface water. But surface water systems actually are the ones that service most of our populations. Our larger systems are surface water systems. Juneau, Anchorage, Ketchikan, for example. And surface water systems have stricter requirements. There's just more risks associated with surface water because contamination it's easier for contamination to occur because of the usage of the water body by animals, by humans, by, you know, whomever's using it. So moving on, I'm going to go quickly. One comment, all the pictures in the slides are all Alaskan systems that I've taken pictures of, or I've gotten inspectors to get pictures of. That one in the top of this slide is a filter that's used for surface water systems. So that just gives you an example of what a large surface water system has to have to filter their water to comply with some of our standards. The next page is state-regulated systems. These are the smaller ones, and what you see in those pictures are what you would find if you have a well at your home. These are very little systems that serve small populations. Our standards are a lot. They're not equivalent to the federal standards. We require quarterly testing, and we want to have some construction approval. These systems serve things like assisted living homes, apartments, daycares, office buildings, gas stations. They tend to be public facilities, but not always. We go down to a duplex. We do not have any standards for a private home or a duplex that's not covered by any state regulations. So that's where the line's drawn. We work with the health department. They provide us some funding to provide services to the 121 assisted living homes that they permit. Otherwise, we're not really spending a lot of time with these systems. We don't have the funding to do so, and they...
Just a quick question on the 25 people. How does that get counted in terms of a restaurant?
It captures some restaurants, most restaurants. There's about 200 restaurants that we consider these small public water systems that have to test their water quarterly because it's basically a food item. You know, at that point, they're serving it to their customers.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, on that point.
Go ahead and Representative Herron.
Thank you. Last year, my co-chair, Munoz, it was a huge issue the co-chair's district is in Salcha, right?
Correct.
What's the status of that?
Representative Herron, through the chair, Salcha, last I heard, the legislature appropriated $25,000 to them last year to try to get their well. This is a fairground well that's providing water to, I believe, about 100 people from around that area. And last I heard, the well broke down, froze up, and they were unable to provide water to anybody at the moment. And they have requested funding to drill a new well and put it into compliance. So that's the status that I'm aware of.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Continue, please.
Okay. And to add on to that, they fell under the state-regulated system, but since they were serving more than 25 people, they were having to shift to the federal. That was the dilemma there. They didn't want to shift to the federal standards. Okay, the next slide then, successes and challenges. The drinking water program is the biggest in the division out of all the programs. It's 57 employees. It's pretty large, five offices. We have staff in five different offices. They provide a lot of technical assistance to help these water systems understand and comply with the federal rules. I sort of, as the commissioner said, we're sort of the grease in the wheels. We are the cushion, so to speak, from EPA and trying to help them understand the rules and comply with the rules. And I think most of our water systems would prefer to be regulated by us than EPA, but we're implementing the same standards. So I think it shows that we do a good job with providing assistance. So there's several things we're doing to try to help these water systems, and I've listed them on the slide, so I'm not going to go through them. A few other things I'll mention that aren't on the slide. We're the only state that EPA is allowed to certify third-party engineers to do inspections for us. So that's we're pretty proud of that because a lot of other states wish they had that. And we go through a pretty extensive certification program to get those engineers to understand our rules well enough to be able to go out to those systems and do what we need to do with them. So that's, I think, a feather in our cap. The other one is EPA has granted us a waiver for hold times for bacterial samples. That's for the only state, again, that can't get a bacterial sample to a lab in time. Many of our water systems, it just is impossible in 24 hours to get a sample in, which is the federal mandate. So they have granted us a 48-hour holding time for bacterial samples, which they threaten to take away all the time, but we're pretty obstinate that needs to stay in place. I know, Co-Chair Feige, you had some questions about, if you don't mind me addressing them now, about monitoring and how we can reduce monitoring for water systems. We have a source water assessment program where we help water systems look at their source water and figure out how to protect it. And if they have a pretty good program to protect that source water, we are able to reduce some of their monitoring requirements. If they can show they're avoiding contamination, then they don't have to continue to monitor for it as extensively. So it's up to the water system to do that extra effort to protect that source water, be it a fence or a sign or, you know, however they're going to do that. But that's an option available to them for some of the monitoring, which is extensive.
Representative Herron, did you have
right on that point is that I appreciate that the department is helping, you know, small water producers. So right now there's a grant process for that help. Has it been well received? Are you getting lots of applications? I mean, it's granted it's open until near the end of February, but how are the applications coming in for this, they call it drinking water protection grant opportunities?
Oh, thanks. I'm sorry through the chair. It's something I hadn't thought a lot about. Yes, they are. They are coming after that, using those resources to evaluate their water systems. We are getting a good reception for that. I forgot about that program.
Statewide? I mean,
yes.
Or is it? Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Once a water system assesses their source water and has a big plan, that it's pretty amazing. It charts all the, you know, the fuel tanks and, you know, all the things that might eventually seep into their water system. It gives them a tool to protect it. Now they can know they need to remind so-and-so to make sure that oil tank doesn't leak. And once they know all the potential risks in their source water watershed. Okay. Then moving on to pesticides, shifting from drinking water. The pesticide program, I put in the statutes, and you probably don't need to see that, but it's difficult for us to explain how we regulate pesticides, and it stems from confusion in the statute, so that's why it's here. There's basically three aspects of the statutes for pesticides, how we just to control them. And the second one is spraying in public places, which was a law passed about 3 years ago now, 4 years, and that we certify and train commercial applicators, which is a really good way for us to make sure pesticides are used safely. But the third one is the difficult one, and that is public pesticide programs. This is a very old statute that sort of says there needs to be a public process if a government sprays pesticides, so mosquito control, for example. The department has interpreted that to mean you need a permit if you apply a pesticide to state land. So that means the railroad or DOT is never able to use a pesticide on roadways or right-of-ways unless they have a permit from us first. And that's just kind of a source of confusion.
Would there be a serious effect if we repealed that?
From Mr. Co-Chair, I would love it if you No, I don't think so. It really has been difficult for us to understand how to make that work without a permit, and the permits have been really difficult to issue. So 4603330 is, I think, an antiquated statute.
Because if you're already approving the product to be used.
Exactly.
Then, okay.
Well, and it sets a double standard because so the railroad and DOT have to meet a higher bar than me.
Right.
I can buy it off the shelf and spray it, but they can't. So it's a difficult situation for them in particular and for us to issue the permit because these are highly contested and we don't necessarily have the expertise beyond what EPA has already done to approve these chemicals to defend these permits.
Okay,
so a little bit about the program. It's only 5 employees. They all are housed out in the MATSU office. As I've said, we issue applications for state land. We also issue, you have to have a permit if you apply pesticides on water. So I have some pictures coming up of all the fish kills, the fishing game dues. They receive permits for us for those, and that is an unusual application. I don't necessarily think we want to get out of the permitting business for water because there's just so much potential for harm there. And aerial applications by helicopter and airplane, you need a permit as well. We conduct inspections. There's some pictures of an inspection that someone's doing at a store just to make sure only registered products are being sold. And you'd be surprised how often we find unregistered products are being sold. So they're very useful. That lower picture is bed bugs, just because those are a hot topic. You want to see what a bed bug looks like. and a mattress. Those are becoming more and more of a nuisance for us. They're not, interestingly, they do not transmit disease. So we aren't necessarily concerned about them from a public health perspective, but we are just aesthetically. It's, you know, disgusting.
Mr. Chairman.
Who's in her hearing, briefly?
I checked the web page, and it's on there, but is the bed bug information, that is just as a courtesy? The department's not doing anything about it.
Correct. Thank you. Representative Herron, through the chair, one of the next program I'll talk about, we do have a sanitation program that regulates public facilities or accommodations. So I guess we don't permit them, but we do help. If a hotel comes to us and has an infestation, we're working with them to, in our food safety and sanitation program, to try to eliminate the pest. There was a school in Anchorage, actually, that we've been working with pretty closely over the last couple months that's had an infestation. Okay. So moving on, I've already mentioned a few of the successes and challenges. That pitchers are the railroad. We were able to issue a permit to the road, the first that I'm aware of, to spray herbicides. It's still being challenged in court, but they were able to apply at least one round. So the top pitcher is what it looked like before, and the bottom pitcher is the after. So it was effective. They used glyphosate. So for those of you who don't know anything about pesticides, that's the active ingredient in Roundup, something that we all use pretty frequently on our household use. And benign, very, very safe product. We do put product registrations online. We have 5,000 products registered in the state of Alaska. So it just gives you, a sense of the world of pesticides. We have primacy as well from the federal government for pesticides. It's the FIFRA, Federal Insecticide Rodenticide Act. So the EPA doesn't give us much money, but we do implement them as their rules in the state. So moving on to solid waste. This is the program that regulates landfills for the entire state of Alaska. The top pitcher is doing it right, and the bottom pitcher is doing it wrong. But it also size is a huge difference. That top landfill, I believe, is Anchorage, and you can tell it's a very large cell. The bottom pitcher is one of our smaller communities. Solid waste basically reviews and approves permits for the disposal of solid waste. That includes monitoring, usually groundwater monitoring to make sure there's not contamination, or seepage running off the landfill, and that extends into the closure of the facility. Often a landfill must do monitoring for years after it's been closed just to make sure there hasn't been any breakages in the lining. And I'm going to just move on to the next slide. There's only 14 staff in the solid waste program. They're in Anchorage, Juneau, and Fairbanks. There are about 300 landfills. All of the large landfills are in complete compliance. They're 100% permitted and running well, very well. There's about 23 of those in the state. Those are, you know, the large community landfills like Juneau and Anchorage, Fairbanks. Where we aren't doing so well is our small ones, the we call them village landfills, right, for lack of a better term right now. They accept less than 5 tons a day. There are about 250 of them in the state, and only 22% are permitted. So we have a lot of dumps or unregulated disposals occurring, and it's a hard problem to resolve. All of our industrial landfills, there's only 26 of those, are permitted, so all of our commercial operators are in compliance as well. There's no funding in this program to help communities build, construct, maintain landfills, which seems to be, some of these communities just don't have the resources for that to do it themselves, and there's no state funding available, really. So we try to provide as much technical assistance as we can to help them. We eliminated a requirement that they have plans, that they do a plan before they can get a permit, because we found they were spending all their money on the consultant to draft up a plan, and then they weren't implementing it or didn't have the funding at that point to implement it. So there was no point in them wasting their money on a consultant. and we eliminated that out of the regulations and now have a kind of an online tool where they can walk through and do their own, a high school student can just come up with their own management plan for a landfill. And we're trying to get that out into communities and help them think through how they want to separate their waste streams and manage them. So the next slide is just a picture. One aspect of the solid waste program is the industrial facilities. This is up on the North Slope. Before we were regulating the disposal of drilling muds, there were a lot of spots where it was just dumped on the tundra. And the companies up on the North Slope have committed to clean those up, even if they weren't originally responsible as part of the charter agreement when they received access to those lands. And so this is just an example of one that's cleaned up. And the top slide is what it looks like before they have removed the drilling waste and re-injected it at one of their grind and inject facilities and then revegetated it. So only about 50 of those left out of 600. So that's been a success story for the program to see those cleaned up and getting off the books. And I just told you all that. So I'm not going to really go over there, but those are some pictures of some of our lesser, you know, facilities that aren't permitted.
Mr. Chairman?
Briefly, Mr. Aaron.
First question, the video contest for the unraveling the story of trash, do you know how many videos were submitted for that contest?
I don't.
Thank you.
Okay, then moving on to food safety and sanitation. The pictures, this shows the gamut of this program on the overview slide. It's vegetables to meat to body art. And, you know, they do a lot of things. And one of our inspectors from Juneau is sitting in the office. I just want to point out, Jason, we're really proud of his services he provides Juneau, and he just wanted to sit in today to see what I do. The first slide I'm going to go into with food is our statutory authority, because I think there's lots of questions about what we do and why we do it in food. 1720 is the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act that dictates food safety primarily. And the overarching thing to remember about the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act is we're to make sure food offered to the public or sold is safe. That's the gist of our mandate. It goes on to have specific items about aquatic farms, labeling, seafood processing. This is where you'll find that farm salmon has to be labeled so people know they're buying farm salmon. And then we have two regulatory chapters in this program to implement that statute. One's food service and one's seafood processing. Seafood processing is such a specific entity. It has its own regulations. The food service chapter does cover the regulation of the processing of other food items like jams and jellies, potato chips, rhubarb juice, you name it. People are very creative with making new food items and what they want to do with them. And so this regulatory chapter covers it. It does not cover animal products, and I'll get into that under the state veterinarian. And I know there's questions about cheese, so I'll specifically talk about that under the state veterinarian. Some people wonder what we do versus the Division of Agriculture. So to clarify, they handle raw products, and we handle processed. So if it's a raw product, you know, eggs, honey, they're the ones inspecting or evaluating them for quality. If it's a processed product, if you take that egg or your honey and you turn it into something, then you would have to comply with these regs. The second piece to this program is the sanitation aspect of it, and that's regulated. There's two statutes that tell us how to make sure facilities are sanitary, but this is where we get that body art, piercings, public toilets, pools and spas, public accommodations, laundromats. It's kind of a mixture of things that over the years people have been concerned about public health in that type of a facility. Some of them are current, like body art, but some are pretty old, like mattress manufacturing is in there. Not aware of any mattress manufacturers in the state, but there's a clause in there that we're to make sure they do it right. So it just
Representative Dick, you have a quick question?
Yes, I do. Kristen, just for, I was really surprised yesterday when you told me this AS 1720. Would you, for the sake of the committee, because I believe this is going to come up quite a bit. This isn't the first time or the last time we're going to deal with this year. So, but I was surprised at if you could give us the date when this AS 1720 came into being.
We haven't made, that I'm aware of, there has never been substantial changes to that since statehood. And that statute or that act models federal legislation about food safety that was 1950s, 1960 era.
Okay.
So we've been struggling with how to interpret it ever since. it's, as you'll see in some later slides, where we draw the line is a very difficult challenge in food safety. Anyway, but the people in this program have to deal with the seafood processor to the tattoo artist, so they have a broad knowledge base they have to be aware of when they visit communities and try to implement these statutes. The basics of what the program does is establish standards for the permitting, inspecting, and enforcing of food processing. Again, I want to clarify that it's processing of food, not whole foods. We don't regulate potatoes, for example, and food service facilities, so we get into restaurants, and setting standards for sanitation at public facilities like public accommodations. We do a lot of education as much as we can, but it's unfortunately, I don't think, adequate. We have 40 staff and 8 offices, so they're spread throughout the state. We have people in Dutch Harbor. We have people in Ketchikan, Sitka, Valdez. These are local inspectors, Juneau, and these are the people that interact with over 9,000 establishments in the state. As you can see, 4,500 restaurants are food processors, about 800 seafood processors, and then almost 4,000 public facilities. So that's the gamut. And that bottom picture is a hand wash sink, or at least it was. But now it's a storage site. So it's an example of what sometimes we find. The basics of this program, there are 26% of the facilities, the retail food now, I'm not talking about processors, this is restaurants, were inspected last year. We have a pretty low inspection frequency that we're not necessarily proud of. It's just... we don't have enough inspectors to reach all the facilities on a yearly basis. We end up getting to them about once every 3 years. We just did a Bethel blitz, actually, last week, where we sent 4 inspectors to Bethel to hit the communities in that outlying area. We hadn't been out there for I don't know how many years, and they did 123 inspections in 2 weeks and found several unpermitted facilities, like a tattoo parlor. So that was one of the issues of this program. It's spread a little thin. We work closely with FDA to implement. If food is sold beyond state lines, it is regulated by FDA. So anything that's sold within the state is up to the state to handle. But if you wanted to sell your product out of state, FDA gets involved. Now, all of our food processors pretty much are regulated by FDA. I mean, all our seafood processors definitely are. A lot of our littler ones that you wouldn't think about are actually marketing their products outside, like Cabela's catalogs for smoked salmon. So they do get their products out there, which is great. Our notices of violation are a little bit higher for our retail food, and that's, I think, to be expected because we're not out there frequently enough, so they don't get that technical assistance they would get if we were there more often. We implemented about 3 years ago a training and testing program. This was amendments to the Food and Drug and Cosmetic Act. This is the only ones I'm aware of that have happened since statehood. But we added a training and testing requirement for food handlers because we weren't getting out to facilities enough. We knew it. We needed to make sure those people that were there every day were handling food safely. We've issued over 90,000 food worker cards online because we know people can't go into a DMV to take a test in a lot of our communities. So we do an online test. So it's an honor system, but... I think it's been a success, so we're proud of that.
Excuse me, Ms. Ryan, if we could just kind of hit the high points. We're running
okay.
A little tight, and
I know,
I'd like to get Ms. Edwards in here as well.
Okay. Successes and challenges, I already mentioned most of these. The bottom one in particular I want to draw attention to is where we draw that line, what we regulate and what we don't. And the way the statute is written about food offered or sold to the public, we have defined that as a public event. a private event. We don't regulate a public event. We do. So if you advertise your event in the paper, we think you need a temporary permit. If you put it in your church newsletter, that's private. That's for the members of that congregation. So that's the best we've been able to decide where we should step in and where we shouldn't. If it's open to the public, we think there's an expectation, or at least the statute implies, that we should make sure it's safe. If it's a private event for the members of a congregation or community, we wouldn't. So I just wanted to point that out. The next slide, quickly. What can be sold off the farm without DEC oversight? There's lots of questions about this, and I know there's interests in our small farms making us stab at starting businesses, so I just wanted to put up here. Here's a list of all the things we do not regulate. Over on the right in the black box are the things we do regulate for hazardous reasons. Peas, for example, we did not regulate the shucking of peas until 2 years ago in the Matsu Valley. There was an outbreak of salmonella because of cranes on peas, so now we've decided shucking peas needs to be regulated because of the injuries. So it's not always common sense what's risky and what isn't, I guess would be the point there.
Representative Seaton.
I don't see milk or milk products on here. Is that a different category?
No, it isn't. I should have put it on. Milk would be in the, you can sell it off the farm through a goat or a cow share program is the way it's currently done. But the cheese is over in the box. We do regulate cheese. And I do have a full slide on cheese because I know there's interest in it. So I'll, if you don't mind, I can hold off on that.
Mr. Chair. Question on this slide, the meat custom process for animal owner, does that mean you don't regulate the custom processing for the owner, or if it's custom processed, you don't regulate selling it off the farm?
We mean that if you go to a farmer and say that I want to buy that cow and I want you to turn it all into sausage, that's your cow.
Thank you.
You can have someone process your meat for you. It was sort of controversial last year. Hunters want, you know, they take their meat to the processor to be custom processed. We don't regulate that, and there were some hunters frustrated because they didn't get their meat back the way they wanted up in Fairbanks. And they wanted it to be regulated, but we don't do that. Mm-hmm. Okay. So just are people getting sick? There's always one questions, you know, about outbreaks. These are just the numbers for the last year from the Department of Health section of epidemiology. The ones in bright pink were related to a facility we regulate. The ones in light pink are probably related to a product that was regulated, and the rest are just what they are. So I just wanted to point out that, yes, people do get sick. You may not hear about it so much, but it does happen. The next slide just shows you the same thing. Those are numbers for the past 5 years. Outbreaks are severely underreported. You know, very few people call their public health nurse if they're sick. So we don't think this is a really adequate representation, but these are definite cases that we have data to prove. So, and then this map is from CDC, and it just shows you how we rank for illnesses reported, and we're actually on the higher end according to that, but that is voluntary data, so I'm not sure I really put a lot of weight into it.
Representative Kawasaki, make it quick.
Yeah, just a real quick question on the food safety and sanitation. The slide just before that, just you pointed out that several of those in pink or red are ones that you do regulate or possibly regulate, and then there's almost an equal number of places that you don't. I'm just curious because it used to be a something the city did was food safety inspections and things like that. I just wondered if you could just tell me why it seems like even though you do regulate these places, there still seem to be incidences of illness.
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, there are several things. I don't know if we'd ever be able to stop all outbreaks, but I honestly just don't think we're out in communities enough. I mean, inspecting a facility once every 3 years isn't probably sufficient to be helping people understand the risks associated with how they're handling food.
And so, Mr. Chairman, just a real quick follow-up. Is there an increment in the budget for that?
No. Okay, so moving on to the state veterinarian. And that's him doing a necropsy on a bison. So you wanted to see Dr. Gerlach in action. He has a variety of statutory authorities, but basically his job is to keep animals from making us sick. That's the overall goal. And that, so that covers making sure we animals have health permits when they move around, but it also means regulating the meat and milk processing. There's a strong veterinary aspect to animal food products. There are only 5 staff in 2 offices, 2 veterinarians. That elk chute on the bottom is something they purchased for elk farmers to use to take samples from their elk to make sure that they were brucellosis-free, and I think it gets quite a bit of use. They monitor animal diseases, respond to outbreaks, and bird die-offs pretty frequently. We get calls of animal bird die-offs and having to help farmers figure out what's wrong in the valley, Matsu Valley, that just happened, and it was feed-related. At least that's the suspect at the moment. Okay, so moving on, successes and challenges. I've given some. We are overdue for the animal health regulations being revamped. This is going to be controversial. This is about animal care standards, and you're seeing more and more cases of people maybe not taking care of their animals the way the society would like them to be. So we need to draft the regulations that decide what those standards are. Right now, it's sort of not been defined, and we're expecting that to be a difficult process. Mm-hmm. To do. Maintaining Alaska's disease-free status so that our animals can transfer freely across the Canadian border is a really big deal to animal owners. And we've permitted a mobile slaughter facility, which is the bottom picture there, so small farmers that want to sell their meat in commerce can do so. And this mobile slaughter facility travels around and can be utilized to do that. Okay. And we've permitted 3 cheese facilities, which is a highlight. What's going on with cheese is the next slide. There's a statute that requires dairy products to comply with a pasteurized milk ordinance. That's been on the books for as long as I know, definitely since the 60s. We've never had regs that really explain how to implement that. We've always just followed the federal rules, which were vague and not very explanatory. So we decided it'd be a good idea to put our own regs together to be more clear and help our operators, and these are the basics that the regs require. So if you have any questions about what we're asking cheese producers to do, that's what it is. We aren't any stricter than other states. I know there's some misperceptions that we're stricter than other states on cheese production, and we are not. We use those as models. There's variances. There's slight differences about testing requirements, but we're equivalent. And at the moment, all our testing is free. Okay, so moving on then, unless there's questions, because I know you're in a hurry. The Environmental Health Laboratory will go very fast. It's just an overview of this facility. Again, if you ever want to come out and see it, you can. They're doing shellfish in those pictures. That's a mouse. That's how we test for paralytic shellfish poison. 17,000 mouse a year.
Oh, my.
Really tired of doing that. I mean the 4 staff are, and they're grinding up the gooey ducks in the top picture. You know, you have to do a composite sample. You grind up the meat. It's pretty intensive, extensive process to prepare the samples just to inject the mouse to see how they're going to react. Developing a chemistry method to replace that. Pretty excited about that. There's a capital appropriation to help us buy a piece of equipment so we can start using this chemistry method to test for paralytic shellfish poison. Do about 70,000 samples a year at that lab, primarily food, but a lot of animal health, a lot of contaminants in fish, a lot of monitoring of fish for contaminants just to see that if we're having sources of global pollution coming into our state. So that's all I'd say.
Okay. Ms. Ryan, thank you very much. One question here from Representative Seaton, and then we'll go on to the next presentation.
Last year, I believe we got an additional position in so that you could certify additional aquatic farm sites. Was that position filled? And have you been able to certify the additional farm applications?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, we did receive an additional position in Ketchikan, where we have a large number of southeast of aquatic farms, and it's filled, and they're actively working now to get those farms permitted. We also are working now with a marine vessel tracking program so that we no longer have to go out on all the sample collections, which is takes a lot of time. And we can just track their vessel now and watch them go out, get the sample, and come back. So we don't have to go spend our time doing that anymore. So we're making some strides in the shellfish arena.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, Ms. Ryan, thank you very much. I apologize to the rest of the members of the committee. If you do have more questions, there's her number on the screen.
You know where to get me.
And take a brief at ease to prepare for the next presentation.
Hey, Chris.
We'll now hear from Ms. Alice Edwards, Director of the Division of Air Quality. Ms. Edwards, welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Yes, for the record, my name is Alice Edwards. I'm the Director for the Division of Air Quality for the Department of Environmental Conservation. So I will try to move quickly. Today I just want to give you an overview of our division, some of what our mission is, our core services programs, and some of the challenges that we're working on at the moment. Our mission in the Air Quality Division is to conserve, improve, and protect Alaska's natural resources and the environment and control through the control of air pollution in order to enhance health, safety, and welfare of the people of the state. Our core services, we have a number of core services that we provide. We issue air quality permits to facilities throughout the state that release potentially harmful air pollutants. We provide compliance assistance and enforcement through inspections and operating report reviews. We provide assistance to communities working to protect their air quality. We conduct air quality assessments and monitoring. We often comment on federal air quality rulemakings to provide Alaskan perspectives into the federal process at EPA. And we develop, implement, and enforce plans to bring areas that are out of compliance with federal air quality standards back into compliance. The division has three primary air quality programs and then an administrative support program. So we're divided into basically four programs. The three primary air programs are air permits, the air nonpoint and mobile source program, and the air monitoring and quality assurance program. And as the commissioner had mentioned, in this division, we're primarily implementing requirements under the Federal Clean Air Act and DEC air quality. We do have primacy for air quality from EPA. As I mentioned, the structure of our division, we have the four programs. The air permits program has is our largest program with about half of our staff located in that program. It's got three primary sub-programs. The Title I are sort of construction and minor permits for facilities that are going to construct new or putting in new equipment or modifying their facilities. We have a Title V operating permit program, which deals with ongoing operations of facilities and also handles our compliance activities for permits, and a technical services program that works on quality management and improvements and regulations and such. We have a nonpoint mobile source program, which is the program that primarily deals with communities and works with them on their air quality issues. And then we have the monitoring and quality assurance program, which oversees the state monitoring network, helps communities that want to do monitoring, and does some quality assurance work for their monitoring networks. So I'll go into these in a little bit more detail. The air permits program, our regulations are found, most of our air quality regulations are in 18 AAC 50. The air permits program, it works to ensure that emissions from industrial operations in the state don't create unhealthy air. They authorize the construction of new and modified facilities, and that's the construction permit and minor permit program, which we often call Title I for Title I of the Clean Air Act. They have worked to establish the compliance monitoring for existing facilities, and that's done through the Title V operating permit program. It's called Title V because it's under Title V of the Clean Air Act. And then they conduct the compliance assurance inspections and the follow-up that happens if they find deviations from the permit requirements when they go out and work with facilities. As I mentioned, the air permits program has an ongoing process for continual improvement. They're always looking for ways to improve consistency and timeliness of permitting. This program also tends to respond to most of the general air quality complaints and concerns that we get from the public. The next program I want to touch on, the Nonpoint Mobile Source Program. This is the program that works with communities. They work to work with various communities to maintain and achieve ambient air quality standards. looking primarily at the non-industrial air quality concerns and helping communities with air quality plans. This program partners with communities to look at options and find solutions to local and regional air quality concerns. So some examples of this are, were already brought up before, the Fairbanks PM2.5 planning. We've worked with Juno on their particulate matter planning, Anchorage and Fairbanks related to carbon monoxide, and we've also been working with rural villages on dust-related issues and other air quality issues. The focus of this group is primarily on what we call mobile and area sources of pollution. In communities, these are things like motor vehicles, the road dust, space heating, non-road equipment, so things that aren't basically larger industrial facilities. This program also conducts a lot of education and outreach on air quality issues to help raise awareness and encourage behaviors that improve air quality. A lot of the sources of air pollution that we have just come from things that people do in their day-to-day lives, driving their cars, using their wood stoves, and we try to encourage actions that people can take to help reduce their own pollution and make air quality better. This program also helps to ensure that the community-based pollution control programs that we have developed in response to non-attainment areas, designations from EPA for problem areas for air pollution, and that have been incorporated into our state plan and regulations, we work with them to ensure that those are implemented. So this is the program that provides oversight for the Anchorage and the commuter vehicle emission inspection maintenance program. We also work with Juno on their wood burning program, helping to provide technical assistance and outreach. So when we have official plans in place that have been submitted to EPA and we have federal and state requirements to carry out those plans and implement those plans, this is the group that tries to help provide that oversight and assistance. The third program I want to touch on here is the Monitoring and Quality Assurance Program. Now, this program operates and oversees air quality monitoring networks throughout Alaska, and the networks are primarily there to assess compliance with the national ambient air quality standards, like the one for fine particulate matter that we talked about earlier. This program also provides quality assurance audits for the state air monitoring network and assists with audits of local air monitoring efforts that are underway. So this is the group that helps to make sure that the data that we're collecting and looking at concentrations of air pollutants in our air is done properly.
Where are those monitors concentrated within the state?
I'm just getting there.
Sorry.
So, here, I'll be happy to answer that. There a lot of the monitoring is concentrated in the primary population centers. Part of this is driven by our federal requirements on where monitors need to be placed within the state. So we have had long-time monitoring networks in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau. We also have some monitors in the Matsu Valley. We have some newer monitors in NOAATAC, which are looking at lead. So in Anchorage and Fairbanks, they monitor for carbon monoxide. They monitor for particulate matter. In Anchorage, they monitor for ozone. In Juneau, we monitor for particulate matter. And also in the Matsu, we monitor for particulate matter. This group also assists communities with special monitoring studies. So while we have sort of a fixed network in these more major cities that are running all the time, we will work with communities to help them do special monitoring studies. Two that we have going right now is the one that just started getting operational in Seward. That one is to look at dust, and that just became operational just within the last few weeks. We also have a monitor that's being run out in Galena where they've been concerned about smoke issues, so that's for fine particulate matter. So this group helps with that. The air monitoring program also is the program that is issuing the air quality advisories. We issue air advisories to inform the public when there are hazardous air conditions. So things like when we have wildfire smoke or volcanic ash or events like that, this is the program that issues those air quality advisories. The program also reviews the industry-generated monitoring data that's used for permitting, so it provides some technical support into the permitting program. And it provides, we have a meteorologist within this program that helps to provide oversight for open burn approvals when folks want to do large-scale open burns for habitat or agricultural clearing or things like that.
Representative Dick, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Really quickly, is any consideration being given to the Arctic haze coming over from Asia? I fly western Alaska, not all the time, but quite often I see that gray cloud that's laying over us, and I know it's not coming from a campfire in Dillingham.
Through the chair, Representative Dick. We have been monitoring, done monitoring related to visibility, and there is quite a lot of research related to Arctic haze. We've just recently been working on our regional haze state implementation plan, which the federal EPA has required every state to do, which has to do with protecting visibility in Class 1 areas. So we've done quite a bit of work looking at that issue, and we are indeed impacted from international sources, both in Asia and Northern Europe, industrial sources. We see Asian dust as well. So, yeah, we do track that as well.
Thank you.
The last program in the division is our administrative support program, which does what most administrative support programs do. They help us with our budget and grants, and but we also do quite a bit of work on fee and billing assistance, as we our permit program is mostly fee-based. So to get to some of the initiatives and challenges we're working on, I have a number of them here. I will try to go through them relatively quickly, but you may have questions on some of these. The first I wanted to touch on, I'd mentioned a little bit earlier, is our efforts for ongoing permit streamlining and process improvement. We have a goal within the division to improve the consistency and the timeliness of our permitting. We want to maintain high-quality, legally defensible permits, and we want to be able to improve the predictability for our industry stakeholders by standardizing our processes and permitting requirements to the greatest extent that we can. To do this, we've established a quality management system within the division. We use that to enhance consistency. We have lots of work instructions. We use it to help with reducing disruptions that can occur from staff turnovers. We get quite a bit of turnover within the division, so the management system is helping us to train and make sure that our staff remain consistent in how they're approaching various aspects of their work. For operating permits, we have a number of standard conditions that we use for permits, standard permit conditions. We use those to improve efficiency, and then we have also been working to meet more with our stakeholders to try and improve our processes and make sure that we're all on the same page and are able to move through processes efficiently. In the construction permit program, we do pre-application assistance, project scheduling, and other techniques to try and keep a predictable workflow for folks that are trying to get facilities up and running. And we've begun using quite a bit of contractor assistance to try to help handle workload fluctuations we may see. So this is an ongoing effort for us. We've been working on it a lot over the last number of years, and I think we have made strides in improving our timeliness, reducing our permit backlogs, and trying to be responsive to our industry stakeholders. The next challenge I want to bring up is the fine particulate matter, which we talked about a little bit earlier, the issues in Fairbanks. This is just a picture of Fairbanks in the winter. You can see the power plant that's near downtown, as well as a lot of the stacks from the smaller sources around town. There's a lot going on in Fairbanks. This is an area of significant effort for the division right now. And so I'm going to spend a little bit of time on it, and I will try to answer some of the questions that came up. As the commissioner mentioned, the Fairbanks North Pole area is exceeding the 24-hour standard for fine particulate matter. We have an air quality plan due to EPA in December of 2012. If we fail to get that plan together or implement the plan, then the Clean Air Act has a number of serious consequences. They can sanction our highway funds. They can sanction some of our industrial activities. So we want to get this plan done. We want to get a good plan together and get it done on time. The plan and the control options have been controversial in the community. The non-attainment area itself is fairly large in size. It includes most of the population of the borough. It's about a third of the size of the total borough. It's smaller than EPA had originally wanted to make it. They wanted it to be much larger. We managed to get enough data gathered to have the boundary made quite a bit smaller. We were and one success in that process was we were able to show that Eielson Air Force Base and a lot of the military training ranges and other portions of the borough were not contributing to the problems within the local community, which allowed them to remain outside the boundary. Right? And so that was a good outcome from that process. Fine particulate matter, it comes from pretty much all combustion sources. So in Fairbanks, there are multiple sources of fine particulate matter. Not only the space heating, the wood heating that we talked about, coal burning. We have coal-fired power plants, industrial facilities in the community. We have motor vehicles. So there's a lot of different places that the particulates can come from. So it's a complex problem. There's a lot of work being done to understand the problem, understand the sources, their impacts, and what we can do to control them. We do know that the home heating sources are a large and significant portion of the problem, but there are other sources there, and we need to explore all of them and look to see what the options are overall to come into attainment with the standard. I do think it is realistically attainable to achieve the standard. I do think it's going to be a complicated and complex process, and there'll be difficult choices to make to get there, but I do think it can be done, and the borough is in the lead on doing the air quality plan. They've taken some proactive measures to try and deal with the wood burning and coal burning sources for residential heating. I listened to the assembly testimony last night, and they're continuing to work on those issues. I do believe the changeouts will help. We have to have better burning practices, and that's part of getting to education and behaviors and how do you get people to do things better. But I do think it's achievable. Some of the efforts that we are doing as a division related to the Fairbanks planning, we're helping to coordinate those planning efforts between the state, the borough, and EPA. We're all very well coordinated. We're all talking to each other, working through a lot of the technical issues and options that can occur up there and things that we can look at to control the pollution. The division is also actively responding to the local complaints about smoke in the community and following up with when we find problems as best we can. We're trying to do a lot of outreach and education, so if we get a complaint and we go out and we find somebody who's burning poorly, we're trying to inform them about what the problems are and try and help get them to mitigate their pollution. So we're working on public education. We are working on a number of projects with the borough to characterize fine particulate matter. A lot of studies going on. There's a lot of technical work going on. The division right now is working on analyzing the emissions from the power plants and other industrial facilities. Those are all permitted facilities that DEC permits, so we're taking the lead to look at those and evaluate the emissions, the impacts, and the potential controls for those sources, so that can feed into the planning process. And the department has also got a contract right now. We're up there testing vehicles, trying to determine how cold weather affects the particulate matter coming out of the tailpipes of cars. And from our past history working with carbon monoxide in Fairbanks, we know that as the temperatures get colder, vehicles don't do as the catalysts and the other emission control systems in cars don't work as well. So we're trying to characterize what those emissions look like so we can do a better job of figuring out how much mobile sources contribute to the problem. So there's a lot of work going on up there. All of the things we do up there, we are doing in conjunction with the borough.
Okay, excuse me, one quick question.
Mm-hmm.
Get a lot of wildland fires in the Fairbanks area. Do the regulations have any allowance for natural sources of PM2.5 particulates?
The EPA does distinguish between the natural sources and the man-made sources.
Yeah.
So there is differences. We do not have to, we aren't having to plan to the worst-case wildfire scenario. We have other actions we take for wildfire smoke. We're having to plan to reduce the man-made pollution, which is primarily and predominantly up there a wintertime problem. In the mm-hmm. summertime forest fire problem, we deal with in a slightly different way. We're still doing air quality advisories and trying to deal with it, but it's handled in a different way, and it doesn't count against us
okay.
in our planning process. Another initiative and challenge I want to touch on is dust in rural Alaska. And this is an area that we've been working on for a while. It's problematic in a lot of parts of the state. I put this picture, these pictures in. This is, I believe, these are out of Kotzebue. And the point I guess I wanted to make with these is in a lot of our rural communities, our roadways are unpaved, which, you know, it may not make sense to pave all the paved roads in rural Alaska, but the homes sit right on the roadways, the businesses sit right on the roadways, people are walking in the roadways, there's a lot of multi-use. So you see in this picture, you see a mother and a child and a stroller and a truck and a four-wheeler, and so there's a lot of potential for exposure to the public in our rural communities. So the next slide just shows a person crossing a road on a windy day. And I believe this is again in Kotzebue, and it gives you an idea. This person is just trying to keep out of the dust. So it's a nuisance in our rural communities, and it's also a potential health issue. I would note that, you know, things like the four-wheelers, we drive a lot of four-wheelers in rural Alaska. The tires on four-wheelers tend to put up more dust than the tires from cars and normal cars and trucks. Speed can make a big difference in putting dust up into the air. So, you know, our mothers, our children, our kids are playing on these roads. They're being exposed to this dust, so it is a concern.
Representative Wilson, quick question.
Yes, real quick. When I was growing up, I lived in a farm. We had a grass road, and we just spread it with oil, and nobody cared. We can't do that now. So is there anything that they can spread on there at all?
There are, and through the chair, I will get to that, Representative Wilson, if you give me a minute. One thing I wanted to mention with regard to dust is we get concerns and complaints from all across the state. From southeast to the interior to, you know, northwest to the western parts of the state. This is a little bit of an older map, but, for example, Seward's not on the list, but Seward has monitoring for dust now, too. So there's a lot of interest in this throughout the rural parts of the state. We recently did a survey and sent out a survey to 255 communities in the state. About 33% of them responded, and of those, that was about 80 communities, and about 60 of those say that dust is a concern to them. I would also like to point out at this point, you'd asked about the fugitive dust regulations that we're looking at. We are initiating an effort in that regard. It's focused. There'll be some workshops coming up. The first one, I believe, is next week at the Alaska Forum on the Environment. But then we are also planning two additional workshops, one in Seward and one in Fairbanks, which I believe will be the first week of March. So we can get more details on when those workshops occur. We do have fugitive dust from other sources than roads. We have material handling like the coal facility in Seward, sandblasting like you see at the dry docks. So the approach that we've been taking with regard to developing fugitive dust regulations for these smaller sources that don't fit into our permit program already is to try and determine thresholds where we think that they might cause a problem with air quality standards. And then we'll be talking with folks and stakeholders trying to determine what options are out there and what's going to be the best way to move forward to try and address the concerns that we have about being able to make sure that we don't have problems with fugitive dust from those types of facilities and not having to rely solely on reasonable precautions. So that'll be coming up here in the next month or so. We'll get that kicked off and started, and hopefully we'll be moving towards regulations, you know, this year. Coming back to the other question from Representative Wilson, we're continuing to work with the Department of Transportation and other agencies to look for solutions to dust impacts from rural roads and to help villages in assessing and addressing their local concerns. One of the projects that we're working on with the Department of Transportation is a pilot project. It's underway right now, wanting to look at the effectiveness of watering and our dust suppressants. So these are basically chemicals that can be put onto a road surface to try and bind the dust and keep it on the road surface and not let it be released into the air. We have 8 communities that are working with us on this project. They are areas where who had come forward to DEC in the past and had done some local monitoring and found problems. So those are the communities of Bethel, St. Mary's, and then a bunch of them in the northwest Arctic, Kotzebue, Noatak, Ambler, Buckland, Norvik, and Kiana. And so this is something that's underway now. The equipment, so they DOT came up with some equipment that could be transported easily out to villages. They've got some different types of products that they're letting the villages try. And then our part of the project is we're going to go and work with a couple of these communities and try and do some monitoring to see if we can determine how effective those products and the applications were in dealing with dust in those communities. Right now, we're looking at partnering and monitoring for Buckland and Ambler. And if we have enough resources, we're going to try and get down into either St. Mary's or Bethel as well. And I just would note with this particular one, it's with the widespread impact of dust throughout the state, it's very difficult to effectively respond to this. So I think we need to find some options that are going to work for these rural communities, something that can be sustained, that's affordable, and can be accomplished. So that's what we're trying to accomplish through some of these pilot studies.
Representative Wilson.
Through the chair, when will that pilot be over so that we can get some information from it?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I think this summer they should be spreading those products, and hopefully we'll have the monitoring. So hopefully by this time next year we'll have some information, more information.
Good.
I'll try and move quickly here. The next issue and challenge that I wanted to just kind of bring to your attention is sort of these national ambient air quality standards. These are reviewed every 5 years by EPA per the requirements of the Clean Air Act. There have been a couple of new ones recently. They've just recently revised the standards for nitrogen dioxide and sulfur dioxide, which are both gaseous pollutants. But they've created these new one-hour standards, short-term standards. And this will have some implications for our permit program. For example, the nitrogen dioxide standard previously had been an annual standard. So now instead of, you know, if you have a facility and it has a blip, it's, you know, has you know, sort of inconsistent emissions across the year, if it has a high value, you have to look at them differently because over the course of a year it would all average out. But if you're having to look at these shorter terms, you just have to look at it differently. So we're working on looking at those standards, how we can implement them, how we can model the impacts from facilities. So it's going to change a little bit of the work we do in our permit program, and that's something we'll be working on over the next year. We're also expecting EPA to revise the carbon monoxide standard and the particulate matter standards again during the coming year. If they propose more stringent standards for PM10 or for which is coarse particulate matter or dust, or for the fine particulate matter, we could have additional areas of the state that now show problems. Same goes with carbon monoxide. If there's a significantly more stringent carbon monoxide standard, then Anchorage and Fairbanks might need to look at those. I think the bigger area of potential change is in the particulate matter standards. And just to give you an idea on the particulate matter standards, I just gave you a chart of how those have changed as EPA has reviewed them over the last decades. Since 1997, and then the 2006 standards, which tightened up the 24-hour standard, and then the standards that they're looking at will likely tighten up the annual standard and may tighten up the 24-hour standard slightly more. So the only area of the state that we're aware of that might have a problem with the annual standard is Fairbanks, and we're already working the issues in Fairbanks under the 24-hour standard. If they go to a more stringent standard for the daily standard or the 24-hour standard, we may see Juneau again, because they're very close to the standard, and we may see some other areas of the state, maybe in the Matsu Valley, that will be near that level. EPA Another challenge that we've been having recently is EPA has been issuing a lot of new and revised rules, which we try to keep up with, and it's difficult to keep up with all the reviews of the EPA proposals. Typically, when we review EPA rules, we're focusing our comments on technical concerns and real specific Alaska issues that we think may arise from the implementation of that rule. A couple of the ones that are coming up or have been promulgated or are coming up, the greenhouse gas permitting rules. Those were promulgated last year by EPA. It's a federal rule that tailors the permitting program to avoid permitting requirements for small facilities for CO2. So they set higher thresholds for CO2 than they have for other pollutants in order to make sure that states didn't have so many facilities to permit that it just didn't make any sense. The federal rule has some phase-ins and basically has been designed to impact facilities that are already getting air quality permits. We have adopted those federal requirements. We did that over the past 6 to 9 months. The approval of the EPA by the EPA of those regulations is underway. We're just waiting for the final Federal Register notice. We understand it's been signed and should be in effect. And what that means is we're not going to have a construction moratorium in the state, and we're not going to have EPA making our permit decisions. At least if we're going to implement these standards in our permit program, we're going to do it as a state program. So I think that's good. Another one that we've been following and has had some notice in the communities throughout the state is EPA has issued an advance notice regarding potential regulation of lead in aviation gasoline. This is an issue where the state weighed in early with Alaska-specific concerns. There have been meetings with EPA about our concerns. This is not something that EPA is moving very quickly on, but by getting in and talking to EPA early and expressing concerns, it's allowing EPA time to gather additional information and to take our concerns into consideration. I know EPA staff will be coming up to the Forum on the Environment in the next week or so to participate in a session on this issue. And EPA did select Merrill Field as one of the places to do lead monitoring. And the issue here is whether or not the lead in aviation gasoline is causing health problems in vicinities of airports. And lastly, we often end up with rules and are expecting rules related to the new ambient air quality standards, particularly with the ones for the one-hour standards. And the key here is when EPA issues their new standards, air quality standards, it's really helpful to the state if they also start to issue their rules and guidance related to how they're going to implement them, because otherwise we have to, you know, it's hard to figure out how it's all going to work. So getting timely rules and guidance from EPA is very helpful in making sure that the state program can then align with the federal requirements. The last initiative I wanted to mention, and I think the commissioner may have mentioned it as well, is our North Slope air quality assessment. As a division and as a department, we wanted to be proactive about issues, air quality issues on the North Slope. Given the desire for additional resource development on the slope and offshore, we wanted to be in a better position to address both the local concerns regarding air pollution, sort of the cumulative impacts of air pollution, as well as trying to help look at where our data gaps are, where additional data might be useful as industry and folks want to try and work towards getting their permits, air quality permits up there. Some of the short-term goals we have for this, we're going to be undertaking to assess and summarize all the existing. We're going to try and go out and find all the existing monitoring, emission, and meteorological data that we can for that region, figure out what additional data needs we may have, focusing on what information would be relevant for permits or these new permits that we may have, new permit requirements we may have to implement, as well as things we might need to cumulatively assess the impacts from all the different facilities that are up there. We're going to be working to develop the technical approach for our modeling effort and trying to determine develop a long-term strategy for monitoring and assessing impacts up there. So this is a place where we're trying to be proactive and hopefully be able to develop data in advance that will be useful and avoid stumbling blocks later on for people that are trying to get permits on the North Slope. And I think think that's all I have. I'd be happy to answer any more questions.
Okay, Ms. Edwards, thank you very much. Just as briefly as you can, I know you could probably expound on this for hours. How much of an impact are the increasing EPA requirements having on resource development in the state?
I think that I think they do pose challenges. I don't know that they're insurmountable, and I think that it's something that we're obviously keeping an eye on. We're trying to do our best to incorporate them into the requirements into our programs in a way that will allow us to manage them. And I think that's the challenge, is trying to figure out how do we bring that into our program in a way, bring them into our program in a way that's going to meet those requirements, have legally defensible permits. There's a lot of requirements. Air quality permits are complex. Mm-hmm. And it takes a lot of effort to get those developed and through the permitting process and through all the challenges and appeals that can occur. So we need to be able to do our best job that we can in trying to address the requirements. And if we do a good job, then hopefully, you know, the permits won't result in a lot of challenges.
Okay. Representative Wilson.
Thank you. Real quick, I'm heard on the TV that on the news, I think, that they were going to be requesting air permits on clear out in OCS. And how are you going to get them? Are you going to have to hover over that area and take them ahead of time and then check it later?
The EPA is working on air quality permits for the Outer Continental Shelf activities right now. And those permits were issued and then were remanded. But a lot of it's done through monitoring data that's been collected on shore and then modeling and based on the specific types of configurations of equipment that they're going to have out there.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Foster, that would be the last one.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned the lead in aviation gas proposed regulations by the EPA. What's the specific proposal there, and how adversely would that affect, say, the air carriers, the smaller ones out in the hubs and so forth?
Through the chair, Representative Foster, EPA hasn't proposed the regulations at this point. There's a multi-step process at EPA to actually get to the point of actually regulating the fuel. The first thing they do is they do what's called an endangerment finding. So part of what this advance notice of rulemaking that they were out telling everybody the data that they had and looking for additional data because the first step they would need to do is to determine whether they believe this fuel is causing an endangerment. If they do, then they would need to take the next step to regulate it. In the case of aviation fuel, they have to work with the FAA. EPA can't do that. They have to do it in conjunction with the EPA or with the FAA. The concern with leaded aviation gas is that at this point there is not a replacement fuel. So it is a huge issue for the state of Alaska because these are the planes, these piston aircraft are the planes that are sort of the lifeblood of our rural economy. It's our rural transportation system. So it is a huge issue. As I mentioned, EPA doesn't appear to be moving quickly to establish a regulation, but there are a number of steps that have to proceed before they could even get to a regulation. And EPA couldn't propose to remove a fuel like that without having some sort of replacement option. It wouldn't occur. So I think it's going to be a process over time for EPA to look at it. They did have a petition filed is what they're responding to. So Alaska's been able to get concerns in early, so EPA knows that this is a large, you know, an important issue for us. And so I'm sure they will be looking very carefully
here. Thank you.
Ms. Edwards, thank you very much. Appreciate your time and effort in the presentation.
Thank you.
The committee on Monday will continue with the DEC overviews. It'll be the Division of Water Quality and the Division of Spill Prevention and Response. And with that, the House Resources Committee will adjourn at 2 minutes past 3.